Welcome to
Yeah,
Trine Days the Journey, Conversations with Publisher Chris Milligan. I am Bruce DeTauris. With us are Sherry Seymour, a former investigative journalist and licensed private detective who wrote The Last Circle, Danny Casolaro's investigation into the Octopus and the Promise Software scandal about Casolaro's mysterious death and the shadowy organization he called the Octopus, which reached into the Mafia, the Cali Drug Cartel, and the U.S. Department of Justice. Also with us are filmmakers Zachary Trist and Christian Hansen, whose four-part documentary, The Octopus Murders, launched on Netflix on February 28th, showing many tales of intrigue and murder concerning Danny Casolaro's investigation into the Octopus. And now, Chris Milligan.
Bruce, thank you very much. And Christian and Zach and Sherry, thank you so much for coming on. You know, I want to applaud you, Christian and Zach, for, you know, doing the work and getting it published, okay? Getting it aired, because I've been looking at some of this stuff for too dang long, you know, and it was very, very nice to see. And I just want to mention a little bit thing here. You know, I was watching the show, and Christian, you mentioned that, well, you started looking at this at 25 and now you're 35 and all kinds of stuff like that. Well, imagine, you know, I was a day before my 19th birthday. Okay. And this was 1968, I guess. And
that's a heavy year.
Yeah. And I come to the house. I'm you know, we're gonna have ice cream and cake, and my dad tells me, he says, well, it's time to have a talk. And he had alluded to it earlier. He'd asked me what I thought about the Vietnam War, and I gave him a flip teenage answer several years before. I says, well, you know, you've got a sack of hand grenades and you got some rice patties, and you go throw the hand grenades for the good guys wearing the white hats. I'd been raised on World War II and John Wayne and everything. And so it's just a flip answer. So my dad says, it's time to have this talk. So he took me into my little, what I called my little brother's room, and sat down in a chair. And he had a friend there visiting him that day. It was a professor from Vanderbilt, Dr. D.F. Fleming. He sat on my little brother's bed, and I was sitting on a chair, and my dad was sitting on a chair. My dad looks at me and he says, the Vietnam War is about drugs. There's these secret societies behind it. Okay. And I figure he's talking about the mafia, you know. And then he says, and communism's all a sham. These same secret societies are behind it all. It's all a big game. Okay. I think my dad's nuts, okay? I've been stuffed under the desk. The Ruskies are going to bomb us, okay? And then they start telling me all about my dad's intelligence career, which had never been mentioned. I knew my dad had been in the CIA. Well, we suspected it. It had been talked between my older brother and my older sister, but my mom and dad had never been mentioned at all, okay?
Your dad was a clandestine officer. He had a cover job?
Well, first, he was overt, okay? He was branch chief head of all of East Asia Analysis Office.
Okay.
Okay.
And it seems like he would know something about the Vietnam War.
Right, right. And then he went covert because they needed somebody to talk to Sukarno, okay? And they needed somebody that was a little bit more liberal. And my dad had been raised in the West Coast and wasn't your typical CIA guy. And so they sent him along with me and the rest of my family. I was a little kid to Indonesia so my daddy could talk to Sukarno. So, you know, I mean, it took me 20 years, okay, to figure out what my daddy was telling me, you know. And here, you know, so I can relate to this journey, okay, that you went on, your 20 and you look at this stuff and you say, gosh, what is this? And then you dive in, okay, go down many different rabbit holes. And
they don't make it easy to find out what's going on.
No,
It seems,
no.
me and Zach have discussed it a lot. It seems that it's like almost intentionally confusing.
Well, you've got, we were looking at in, I started looking into the subject I called CIA drugs. I mean, that's what he was talking about, And it was very interesting because in the little research community of CIA drugs, we had a bunch of people that were sent in there to, well, you guys want to look over here, and we came to find out that some of it had been through what I, there's two sides of CIA drugs. There's CIA drugs or narcotics importation, then there's CIA drugs, the dark side, the MK Ultra, and they'd been involved with some of that. So it was very, very interesting. And then through my research in CIA drugs, I met Sherry Seymour, okay, which I was, first I came across her book online, I mean, Sherry wrote a book, and instead of just, getting it published, she put it online for everybody to read.
Yeah,
And
that's a part. Sherry, did you intentionally leak your manuscript online, or did you give it to someone and it got online? It was through a university, if I'm not mistaken.
right. This was, I gave it to someone, John McCain, and James Warner wanted it. And so I sent it to them because they were going to open a congressional hearing on the manuscript, the first 15 chapters. And it ended up at Cornell University, and the employee, the computer technologist there at Cornell University, put it on the internet
And
in
this is
such
like
a
early
way that
internet days,
nobody, yeah, this was
like
in
96,
1995, yeah, 96.
95. Okay.
And that in such a way that nobody could ever get it down. And then they told me about it, that they had done that. And anyway, so then he wanted a cover sheet for it. It was already up there. He wanted a cover sheet explaining it. So I sent a cover, I sent him a cover sheet, which said that I was doing the research on it, and any investigator that could come up with more information on this, to add to it. I was setting it out there. It wasn't my intention to put it out there, but it was already up, and by then it was too late to get it back down. Cornell
You
University.
published that book, or you that manuscript you were writing under a pen name,
Yeah,
Carol
my
Marshall.
sister, Carol Marshall, that was my sister's name, my deceased sister's name. And so I used that name, and for many years. It was the first. This was just one that you could had access to the internet. That was the first about Danny Casolaro on
Yeah.
the internet itself. The other articles that had been written by Ron Rosenbaum and Vanity Fair and so on, they were periodicals,
They were
but
in
the first in
scrapbooks. Yeah.
right and the first internet version was the manuscript, and it created quite a firestorm, and this went on for quite a long time. And then ultimately I was contacted by High Times. I was doing articles for them. I did a huge article on Danny Casolaro called The Ghost of Danny Casolaro for High Times magazine. And
What year was
then
that,
that would have been,
approximately?
oh gosh,
In the 2000s or the late 90s?
2001.
Okay.
August
Okay.
2001 issue.
Wow.
And then it was a huge mini page article. And then Trans High Corporation wanted to publish it, and they sent me a contract. And a friend of mine at Universal Studios, a lawyer, read it and said, this is a really bad contract. So then Chris contacted me. And I talked to him for 30 minutes. And from that moment on, I have been a devoted fan of Chris. I went with him. I went with the contract he sent me. Everything was fair. That was 13 years ago. He is still my hero, and I call him Lionheart. He's an incredible person as well as publisher.
Well, Stormbird and
Sherry.
Lionheart.
Yeah.
You got it.
Yeah. Well, Sherry, I mean, your work was an incredible find because, CIA drugs, it was quite obvious that something was going on. Okay, but then trying to get down into the weeds and figure out it, was quite the journey. And you were one of the first people to really get down into the weeds Okay, because you were trying to figure out how come all these drugs were there around Maricopa, right?
Well, not just the weeds. No, the real life, really scary, really bizarre con men, criminal spies that other reporters only would talk about or maybe talk to on the phone. You became their best buddy or what? No, you got right in there. You met them. You went, you know, that was amazing.
Followed 3 months after Danny Cafflaro's demise, his death, I jumped on the trail and I followed it. And I find, and this is something I would like to mention. I followed all this. I had his documents that I got from the university. They were still archiving them. And I started following his trail. And the story, just like what you have in the documentary, the story is the story. In other words, you can go at the story from different angles, but the truth is still the truth. And what's so amazing to me when I saw the documentary is that it follows the exact same trail I followed. You came to all the same conclusions that I did, completely separately from me, completely individually. And we came to the same conclusions and found the same facts. And that to me was amazing to see that on, to see your investigation was completely separate from mine, and yet we all came to the same truths that Danny did.
It's sort of like a peer-reviewed journal or something, you know?
It was amazing. You know, I want to congratulate both of you. You've done everyone proud, and you've done especially Danny Cafflaro proud.
Amen. Zach, what was it like following Christian about? I mean, how much did you know about the story, you know?
Well, first off, you know, Christian and I are friends from a long time ago. So I think that we had a bond that was necessary to do something this complicated, this difficult, and this long period of time. It would have been very hard to do with somebody that you're not close friends with, and that you don't like being around. So, you know, I came to it, my background is more in independent film and, you know, narrative stuff. I'd never done anything close to this before, you know, documentary style, or, you know, a long form documentary. And so I was just the friend who Christian would tell about, you know, was researching the private prison industry and came to Wackenhut and started telling me about Danny Casalero, who had also started looking into Wackenhut. And at first it was kind of like, oh, that's interesting. You know, I mean, I knew Christian as a New York Times photographer, you know, that was his job. And then he starts talking about this other stuff. And I was like, well, what about the photography stuff? And it's like, that sort of became a lot less about f-stops and, you know, photographs or whatever, and a lot more about this Danny Cafflaro story. And so I was just a sounding board for him for a long time. And then, you know, we did not plan on making a documentary, but when he told me that Michael Reconosciuto was getting out of prison, at that point, you know, I knew just the basics of the story. So I knew that Michael was an important character in the story for Danny and Christian. And, you know, I just said, you know, we're going to regret it if we ever wanted to make a documentary, or even if you want to make your book, like, you will just regret not picking him up from prison. And so in 2017, that's where we really started, and with no intention of any what it would become, but we just took a risk and got on a plane and met Michael. And that's really where my journey into this formally begins.
So Michael, I can never say his last name. I was very proud of the people in the film saying his name correctly. Sherry and Christian, what do you guys think of him?
He's a very interesting, very brilliant, brilliant guy. He's a complicated figure. I personally like Michael. Like, we've spent a lot of time together, and I think he's a fascinating and intriguing, you know, it's really such a shame that he had to do such a long time for doing drugs. I don't know. He's a complicated guy. I don't think he's a bad person. I don't know. It's
Sherry, what's your take on Michael?
Well, I spent 3 months talking to him on the phone. He would call me every day, sometimes two or three times a day from jail. I never met him before he had was in jail. And he would call me and we would talk. And he gave me permission to tape record because what he talks about is very complicated. And so he allowed me to tape record all the conversations and for 3 months. And then ultimately I went and interviewed his nemesis, Robert Booth Nichols. And Nichols kept telling me during the meeting that Michael was going to kill me. This is in the book. This is the chapter 12 is all about my meeting with Robert Booth Nichols. And by the way, I'm the only person that ever interviewed Nichols besides Danny. So, but I left that meeting and basically I never accepted a call from Reconosciuto after that. Not that it was his fault. It's just that I was getting deeper and deeper into this netherworld. And at some point, Reconosciuto's wife called me and said, get out of the house, run. And this was 1 week after I had interviewed Nichols. They're coming to get you, and so on and so forth. And I didn't really know what to do. So a friend of mine who was chief of police in Merced came down with his car, and they put a bulletproof vest on me, put me in the back seat of the car, down on the floor, and drove me out of Mariposa. I ended up in Galveston for 3 months. Then I came back to work at the newspaper and went back to being the editor at the newspaper. And that was, you know, my experience with that. So I never basically spoke with Michael until Mike Abell was arrested. And which is the very last person that Danny Casolaro was investigating. And when Abell was arrested, I contacted Reconosciuto in jail to get more information from him, because he was trying, through Danny, he was trying to trade Mike Abell for entrance into the witness protection program. And then after Danny died, then Reconosciuto jumped over to me and wanted me to be the go-between between him and the FBI and provide the Mike Abell information to the FBI. And which I
and
did.
And you started working on brokering a deal for him or something. You put him in a position to get one. You got a high level, I can't remember what agency, but a high level
government
investigator to begin having conversations with Michael.
My husband was in during the Vietnam War, was in Cambodia in military intelligence, and he has contacts. But anyways, we both have top secret security clearances. So people take it seriously when I start talking to the government. They basically trust me. But anyways, no, I was the FBI agent came to my house and he would talk to Michael on the phone. And Michael was trying to make a trade. He wanted to get into witness protection. He was going to sell all the work that he was doing on Promise, laundering money on the Promise software. He was going to trade Mike Abell. Now, at that time, Mike Abell was a prestigious lawyer in Washington, D.C., former Department of Justice, Director of International Affairs before he retired.
He wrote the extradition treaty between, or he was like one of the main authors of the extradition treaty between the United States and Colombia.
Right.
So
right.
Then he became the darling of the Cali cartel, who had formerly been calling themselves Los Extraditables. The one thing they hated more than anything was the thought or the possibility of being extradited to the United States, because they could handle Colombia. And so then they befriend, they bring into their family the guy that wrote the extradition treaty, knows all the loopholes, and every time they got in trouble abroad, Mike Abell was able to get them out. They loved him.
Michael was aware, that's what he was trying to trade, because Abell was actually working for Gilberto Rodriguez and Jose Londoño, leaders of the Cali cartel. And ultimately, someone from San Francisco, I have no idea who it was, sent Scott Lawrence customs in Boston, and that information got to him. And that's a long story, which I don't want to take up the space right now here. It's in the book. You can read all about it in the book. Anyways, he followed Micah Bell to Bogota, Colombia, to the doorstep of the Cali cartel. And ultimately, Bell was arrested and indicted. He was indicted and then arrested for laundering money for the Cali cartel. Now, this is what Michael tried to trade even when he was first arrested. And this was long before. And then he tried to go through Danny, the last 5 days of Danny's life. When he was in Martinsburg, he was trying to obtain information on Micah Bell, even went to the Department of Justice. And what was funny was he bounced this off Robert Booth Nichols, and he told Bob Bickle. He would confide in Bob Bickle that he had was tracking a Bell and that he had spoken to Nichols about it.
Bob Bickle was just, I'll just interject. Bob Bickle was an informant for customs. He worked in the offshore oil industry in off the coast of Texas, I guess in the Gulf of Mexico. Anyways, and he was a source of Danny's. I'll send it back to you, Sherry.
Right. Well, anyways, personally, I think the fact that Danny was investigating Micah Bell, that and calling Nichols about it, I think I don't know if I should stick my neck out here now, but I think that Nichols became very worried about that and actually flew out to talk to Danny about it and warned Danny, you're in very dangerous waters here. You better shut that down. And Danny called Richard Stavin and Thomas Gates, FBI agent Thomas Gates in LA, and Richard Stavin, former head of the drug
strike force.
Strike force. And told them, I've been told to shut down this investigation. Do you think I'm at risk? And this was going on during the 6th of August. Danny was found dead on the 10th. So he was into some, and I personally believe that somehow Bell, because Danny was walking around the Department of Justice asking about Micah Bell, that Bell learned about it. Nichols knew about it. Ultimately, I think the Cali cartel found out about it.
Yeah.
And at that point, Danny was in a lot of trouble.
It's also, this is just an interesting data point. I don't want people to draw any conclusions, but within a few days of Danny's death in Martinsburg, one of the top Colombian hitmen for the cartels was arrested in New York City. Just throwing that out there.
Yeah. Very interesting.
Yeah. Drugs is all through this conspiracy and corruption. And just to mention again, Sherry's book is called The Last Circle, and your guys' thing on Netflix is called An American Conspiracy, The Octopus Murders. And, you know, I got an email from someone who's been emailing me about the Promise software for a while, and she watched your Netflix thing, and one thing she saw was that in the clip on John Nichols, there was a degree showing on the wall from Blathy College, province of Ontario. And it's a place that does these false degrees. So we get into this milieu where you have, you know, fake bishops, orders, you know, like the Shikshini Knights. And, you know, you have a bunch of intelligence people involved in this. And so, I mean, you've got a wild milieu out there where this is operating in.
I'm so impressed that they saw that was an Easter egg. That is John Philip Nichols' actual diploma that we got on loan to us. So yeah. I'm so glad they caught that.
Right. So let me ask you just a little question, Chris. What did you think of people calling you a conspiracy theorist?
Have people called me that? I haven't noticed. I mean, you know, I guess I have. I'll prefer the term investigator personally, but you know.
Well, I guess I don't know. Maybe I'm sensitive about it because, you know, that's what they started calling me a conspiracy theorist in the 70s, and it wasn't a wasn't a compliment. And, you know, you find these, you want to call them rabbit holes. And, you know, I've been down about every one that I could find. And, you know, one of the first things I learned is that a conspiracy theory doesn't have to be true to be effective to make people do things. Okay. Yeah. How many false conspiracy theories did you run across?
Oh, I remember a lecture. I watched a lecture that you gave a long time ago. And I remember you're talking about conspiracy theories and around the time when you were 19 and you were beginning this process, and you start out, you know, looking into the JFK assassination and other kind of like conspiracy things. But then before you know it, you're reading kind of sober books about the banking industry, you know, and just you're getting so deep in it, you're just trying to figure out how things work. And, right. And I thought that was a really interesting point that you made. You know, you can get outside of the genre of conspiracy theory and you can start to see it everywhere.
Right.
Especially with banking, you know, there's a lot of
example. I mean, that's one thing, you know, the people, you know, it's kind of to not get people to look here, they'll say, well, there's a conspiracy over there, it's over there. No, it's these people, it's those people. And, you know, it really, you know, I narrowed it down to intelligence agencies, drug runners, and secret societies is what I found to be the main players on it.
The amazing thing is that the JFK assassination was the term conspiracy theorist, I think, is it was originated or popularized during the JFK assassination, which was an actual conspiracy. The CIA killed the president of the United States. And
I don't think the CIA quite killed him. I think there were people in the CIA involved with him, but it wasn't the CIA operation. You know,
Christian, the CIA sent a memo to many of its offices in 1967 saying, rally our assets in the media to disparage these people who are critiquing the Warren conclusions as conspiracy theorists. That's where that phrase actually got attached as an epithet against people who were looking for the truth. The CIA wanted to slander folks with that.
There's a moment in the book, The Devil's Chessboard, sorry to talk about a different publishing company, where this student at, I think like UCLA, confronts, Alan Dulles at a lecture he's giving at the university, and they like go toe to toe. He gave Dulles the opportunity to meet with him privately while he was in town, and he said, if you have something to say to me, you can say it in front of the whole place. And this kid was so prepared, and he just owned Alan Dulles. I was reading that part of the book, I was just like, wanted to like jump up and cheer. And then Alan was like, you guys don't want to hear this wish-wash, this idiocy. And everyone, all the other students were like, no, we want to keep talking about it. And then Alan Dulles storms off. And then the guy holds like another hour lecturing his fellow students all he's learned about all the problems in the Warren Commission.
Yeah, well, I really enjoyed the way that you told the story in your documentary. And you kind of get to a false end, and then you go on and show, well, it, you know, there is some stuff here. It is continuing. And now Sherry, I wanted to ask you about, if I can remember it here, I just had it in my head. You were looking into, you had this accident with Queen Elizabeth. Okay. Now, what does that have to do with this story?
Well, first, something I want to put out there, isn't it exciting that all of us got to see this visually, finally, to see a documentary where you can see the visuals? I mean, that is something really new.
And hear John Philip Nichols' voice and hear all these people's.
Exactly. I mean,
you talk about your tapes, you know, but it was cool to hear people.
Nobody, to my knowledge, has put anything out there like this, anything like it at all. And I mean, you can write about it, you can have it in a book, you can have photos, but when you see it in a movie, it's just mind-boggling. It's so much more real, you know, so much more exciting. But anyway, in answer to your question, Chris, I was a reporter reporting on drug activity in Mariposa, and I ended up in the White House. And I followed it right up into the White House. You know, so what can I say? It was, there was drug activity. There was corruption in our Mariposa Sheriff's Department. They were bringing drugs in from Costa Rica. They were distributing them up there in the national park. There was a park ranger named Paul Berkowitz. And I think, Chris, you published his book later, years later. But he was a park ranger, and he went to Congress about the drug activity in Yosemite. And everybody was involved. The LA Times at one point, over the murders up there, even made a statement that Mariposa was the meth capital of California. Okay, because this is a very, very rural area at the base of Yosemite National Park. At that time, when I was there, there was only 3,000 people in the town, population of 3,000 people. And I was the reporter, and the sheriff, a couple of really honest sheriff's deputies, one of them was a guy named Frank McCoy, came in as a reporter, wanted me to investigate the drug activity within the sheriff's department, which I did. And I followed it up. There was a man, a commander, that had been raised in, his father was military intelligence, and he had been raised, as I remember, in Japan, in military intelligence, and he ended up in Mariposa as a commander at the sheriff's department, and the queen was coming up to Yosemite, and the Secret Service agents were accompanying her, and they were killed. The commander, that same commander, ran them off the road accidentally, and they were killed. And what happened was, years later, Ron Williams, who was one of those Secret Service agents, became the head. He was the Secret Service agent who guarded Reagan. And he ultimately became a private investigator when he retired. But he came to my home, and we did some research on all of that. And it ended up in the company in Fresno, the company. And Danny Casolaro was going to talk to Lexington FBI about that the week that he died. And they were en route to visit with Danny. They were going to come to see him in Martinsburg. And they learned he died. I actually called the Lexington FBI, and they said they learned that he had died, and they turned around and went back to Lexington. And so that was two agents that he was going to provide information to on the company, which he learned about from Reconosciuto and Robert Booth Nichols.
And if I was an FBI agent, I'm not a cop. If I was an FBI agent and a guy I was going to meet died, in a weird way, I probably would maybe go to the town instead of just turning around and try to figure something out. Just saying. Zach,
yeah.
You were going to say something?
I was just going to give some I mean, maybe everybody who listens to this or watches this understands what the company is, which is, but just as a basis for those who don't, which is that it's essentially a drug ring that involved a lot of people who were in both, mainly in federal and state and local law enforcement. So people who are in a position to know what investigations are happening and subvert those so that they can make a ton of money in the drug business in both Lexington, Kentucky and Fresno, California, right?
Right. The company was out of Lexington.
The San Francisco Chronicle, written by a very prestigious reporter, Bill Wallace, published on April the 28th in 1982 a story called Spies, Stolen Arms, and Drugs, and it was called The Company. The organization had 300 members, former military men and ex-police officers, and $30 million worth of assets, including planes, ships, and real estate. This was in Fresno, which was 80 miles outside of Mariposa. Imported billions of dollars worth of narcotics from Latin America, involved in gun running and mercenary operations. Danny was investigating that. You'll see that in his notes. He was on top of that. So he was getting into that with Lexington there were so many tentacles that he was investigating. And you, both Christian and Zachary, when you came to my home, when you called me and wanted to do an interview, I said, sure, come in. You can see all the documents and tapes and whatnot. You wanted to do an interview. I said, no. Then you convinced me to do 1 minute. And then I agreed to 1 minute. And then you said, well, how about 3 minutes? I said, okay. And you arrived at my home with this film crew and all this really expensive equipment and lighting and blocking out all my windows from the outside and so on and so forth. And we ended up doing 3 8-hour interviews over a period of 3 days, which was supposed to start it out, was supposed to be 3 minutes. And this is, Chris, this is how good these guys are. And you know how hard it is to get an interview with me, right?
Oh, absolutely.
And they were so professional and so good. And they make me feel like a celebrity, right? I had so much fun being interviewed by Zachary. And Christian was out in the garage. It was February. It was freezing. He's out there with the
San
garage.
Diego. Okay. It's freezing in San Diego. Yeah.
Well,
you come visit me at Sherry in New York. You'll find it's quite freezing, actually. This
you were
is actually
in
freezing.
You were in a jacket, though, with the garage door open, standing there with all the lights on in the garage, photographing boxes and boxes of documents. I mean, you guys.
Sherry's
are
archive
amazing.
Is legendary. It is the stuff of legend. Her archive of original primary source materials, and she allowed me to spend 3 days copying all of it.
Well, and the other thing is, she said that we treated her like a celebrity, but for us, Sherry is a celebrity.
That's true.
In this world, and she was, we were just so lucky, basically, because Christian and I mean, I hate to peel back the veil too much on how much of a janky operation we really are running, but you know, we just flew out to California and went from the northernmost point to the southernmost point, essentially meeting people along the way with this idea that we had a whole film crew coming out in the next month, and we just had to dig up any interview that we could find of the people who really were involved with this story on the West Coast. And we had, it's a lot easier for us on the East Coast because we could just travel down to DC, but with the West Coast, it was like we had one shot to accomplish this. And maybe Sherry just read the desperation in our eyes of how much we talked to her and how big she loomed in this story.
No, I will tell you, you should know this because you're going to have future interviews. When you walked in my living room, you knew every name. You knew everything about the octopus story. I call it octopus language, and you spoke it. You knew the book better than I know the book, okay? The Last Circle. And I was so impressed with your knowledge of it. Hey, we could talk any name, and you knew exactly everything there was to know about it. So we could communicate, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that's when I decided to do the interview. It was because that.
I just want to check. That's what was really fun for us on the crew, me in particular, was seeing two kindred spirits, Christian and you, who are separated by, you know, time and space, but they get together in the same room and they're talking the same language. It's like, you know, two long lost twins or something who can finally communicate with somebody because there's so much information, there's so many stories that only they really no, and they're the only people who have genuine, true fascination with it. And it was just hilarious seeing you guys get together and just chop it up together about all this stuff.
Oh, yeah. See, this guy just come in, and both of you, and knew everything, you know. And you were correcting me. You were correcting me when I would get some of my dates or whatever. You would actually give me information to get it straight. You know, there was one more thing I want to mention. You interviewed people that nobody ever interviewed. I mean, you were going up to doors and tracking people down. I will never know how you found these people. You know who I'm talking about, Glenn, you know?
Yeah.
And then you got the interview with out at Cabazon and whatnot. These are people that nobody's ever interviewed before. So you've added a lot to the story.
Well, you talk about visuals of seeing it in a documentary form. And I think one of the things that we're most proud of is the video deposition that you see of Robert Booth Nichols, and that transcript had existed on, somebody put his transcript of his deposition in 2008 on the internet, but, and so we knew what he says on a technical level, but it's totally different when you see how he says it and the way his voice is, the who he's looking at in the room. He's obviously so angry to be there, and he's staring down his own lawyers, and just being able to absorb what it is like to actually spend time with him. You know, the only people who really know that experience besides, you know, in this story are you and Danny. And so it's, right. It was cool being able to present him and his, the way he carries himself, the way he dresses, the way he looks, to actually see it like you saw it.
That interview in chapter 12 of the book brought so many law enforcement people to my doorstep. This was before it was actually published. The word got out that I had interviewed Nichols. I had FBI. I had John Cohen from the Judiciary Committee calling me. I had Thomas Gates from the FBI and Scott Lawrence from Customs. I mean, the list goes on. Just because I interviewed Robert Booth Nichols, you know, it was pretty amazing that they had such an interest in him. But, you know, you got the voice on there, and you also got that film of Nichols being depositioned on the, in the Samuel Israel case.
Yeah.
And he allegedly died, what, within 2 or 3 months after that, correct?
Yeah.
You know, the point you made about being able to talk to each other is something that really comes home to me, because I started looking into this stuff, and I would go, and there was, it took about 10 years before I could find somebody that I could talk to about it, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm really you know, really proud of what you guys have done. I mean, it's first of all, you got it aired, okay, and it's just a dynamite show. Now I finally remembered, Sherry, what I wanted to ask you about besides Queen Elizabeth was, we met, I don't know, in LA a couple of years ago. And one thing you were telling me, that there were some people and they were waiting for Ed Meese to die, okay, before they could talk. And Ed Meese is still alive, sadly. And you know, because you start looking into this stuff and you see, well, there's a group of people that, you know, they have access to, like, you know, phone conversations, you know, they're able to have all this access to secret information. Okay. And so if you have people running around that have access to this secret information, doing plans, I mean, they're in a much better position to do that. So what was the story about Ed Meese?
Whoa, you just opened a Pandora's box there, Chris.
Well, I try.
Yeah, well, you did it. And I'm sure Chris and Zachary are well aware of this too. Because they interviewed Thomas Gates. Thomas Gates, the FBI agent that's in the documentary, and had called me, was wiretapping Robert Booth Nichols. And in the wiretap, this is the key to everything as far as I'm concerned. They were wiretapping Robert Booth Nichols, talking to Eugene Giaquinto and people in MCA Corporation. And Giaquinto was would brag about his relationship with John Gotti, the head of the Gambino crime family. Okay. And in the wiretaps, they captured Richard Stavin and Thomas Gates captured Giaquinto saying that he would call Edwin Meese and have the FBI's investigation stopped. Now, you have to get the picture of this. You have the FBI and you have Gates and you have Stavin listening on wiretap to somebody saying that they're going to call the attorney general and have their wiretap shut down. And it was. And it was sealed. Well, after Danny died, Thomas Gates was able to get, for the first time in the history of the FBI, to get permission to give information to the House Judiciary Committee on Innslaw. And they went secretly to John Cohen, who was the investigator for the Inslaw for the Judiciary Committee, and secretly provided him with copies of those wiretaps. And so I, just before the book was published in 2009, I contacted both of them via email, and I got it in writing, emails from them, that of what was in those wiretaps. And they confirmed what I just said. And so those, that information ultimately was never put in the DOJ report on the death of Danny Casolaro or on the Inslaw report. Nothing about those wiretaps, what was in them, was ever published publicly.
That John Meese Cohen, was shutting down investigations into the mafia.
Right. Yeah, the relationship between the Department of Justice and MCA Corporation. Howard, was it Howard Baker?
Well, I mean, the MCA Corporation, that what's the name of that talent agent?
You're talking about the head of MCA? Or
yeah, Ronald Reagan's Washington. Old talent agent who...
Right, right, right.
So you're saying to the Department of Justice, but also the president.
Yeah.
Wasserman, well, right. Wasserman.
Yeah. Lou Wasserman. But the one of the members of the board of MCA became Ronald Reagan's chief of staff, Howard Baker. And when he left the Reagan administration, he went back to the board of MCA Corporation. So MCA and the Reagan administration were very, very close. And MCA also funded Reagan's campaign. And so the fact that Giaquinto was the head of, who was on Robert Booth Nichols's corporation, was the head of the home entertainment division of MCA Corporation. And he was talking to Edwin Meese from, you know, MCA talking to Edwin Meese, but also talking to John Gotti. And
it makes such a good movie, whatever was really going on in the, like,
okay, we got about 4 minutes because you guys got to leave here.
Yeah. Well, this has been so fun. What a great conversation. We should do this again sometime.
Anytime. What's been the response so far? What have you guys heard?
A little bit. Just because I feel like we talked about this a bit, but there's a narrative that I'm guilty of kind of pushing out there, which is that this is sort of a viewpoint into how it feels to go into lack of a better word, a conspiracy theory. And it is partly that. I don't retract that. You see the process of Christian and me and Danny and everybody going into this story, but it's been interesting to see how people, Sherry, of course, it's interesting to see how people in a certain corner of the media just use that meta narrative about, oh, this is just a story about a conspiracy theory and the dangers of going into a conspiracy theory. And we tried to be very specific in our telling of this story, not to generalize to any other conspiracy theory or whatever. We just wanted to tell this very complicated, very broad story on its own terms and try to separate fact from fiction and see where what, like you were talking about, where the intermingling of fact and fiction actually serves its own purpose, which we get into eventually, but not generalizing it to, any other people or any other situation, really. We're not bringing it up to modern times or anything like that. So
we're not harassing the parents of the Sandy Hook massacre. Yeah.
So it's interesting to see people use the meta narrative about, oh, it's about a conspiracy theory and what it feels like, instead of grappling with the just the specific.
Nothing to see here.
Yeah.
You know? It's wild. It's weird. They never get, you know, into
really
what happened. It's like, no, we get into a lot of what happened. Just
and we document it really well.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Have to speak up for ourselves a little bit in that respect. I just wish people would actually look at the things we got rather than the shiny, fun colors they're seeing on the screen.
Well,
you got it all.
Yeah, it's a great show. It's called American Conspiracy, The Octopus Murders on Netflix, and based a lot on Sherry Seymour's book, The Last Circle, Danny Casolaro, Investigation into the Octopus and the Inslaw. And there's so much more that we could have talked about. You know?
Oh, I wanted to, can I leave with the epigraph from The Last Circle?
Sure.
But if my words be seed that may bear fruit, of infamy to the traitor whom I gnaw.
Amen. Onwards to a better future.
Amen.
Thank you, Chris.